As you well know, my name is Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm less glad to be here than I was earlier, but I'm getting used to it. I hope you all are. I'm a little reminded of a story I heard about an AA speaker one time. He was at this facility, and he was making this AA talk, and after about the second hour of his talk, he had got through World War II and was just about to move on, and he noticed that there was a gavel on the podium, and so as he went along and made points, he'd bang the gavel, and about the 2.5 hour mark, he made a point, and he started to hit the gavel on the podium, and the head came off of it and hit an old boy in the front row right in the middle of the head, and he just fell over on the floor. And his friend bent down to him and said, "Can you hear me? Are you all right?" And he said, "Yeah, hit me again. I can still hear him." So are you ready for this? The question is, are you entirely ready? Now, I have to tell you, this is a failing of mine. I heard this story that one time about this fella who was had his own company, and he had reached his 50th birthday. And in the years preceding that, he had a young lady who worked for him that he was very attracted to. But as the Bible says, of him she would have nothing. But he kept kind of moving along a little bit, and that day on his 50th birthday, she came up to him and pinned a lapel on his, pinned a flower on his lapel, and said, "Boss, you know, I've been a little standoffish with you, and I want to wish you happy birthday. And I'd like to tell you that if you'd like to get a little better acquainted with me, maybe we could form a little more meaningful relationship if you came over to my apartment after work today." And he was ready to do that. That's ready. And she said, he said, what time do you want to synchronize our watches here? And she said, "Well, come over about 5:30. And he said, I'll be there. And at 5:30, his fist hit the door, knocking on the door, and he was ready. He was even more ready than he had been that morning. And she let him in. And they sat on the couch and visited for a little while, and she asked him if he'd like to take a drink, and he'd like to have a drink, and he was willing to take a drink. And he took off his coat and loosened his tie, and they were having a nice conversation. She said, would you mind terribly if I slipped into something a little more comfortable?" And he said, no, go right. He was ready for that to happen. So she went off in the bedroom, and he noticed that his chest began to expand, and his neck got bigger. And he took off his shoes and his socks, and he unbuttoned his shirt, and he called out to her, and he said, are you ready? And she said, "No, not yet. But he was becoming more and more ready as the time went along. Finally, he had taken off all of his clothes. And he called out, are you ready now? And she said, "I'm ready. Come on in." And when he went through the bedroom door, he was entirely ready. Entirely ready. The only problem was his whole office staff was in there, and they said, "Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you." And then he knew humility, like we're talking about in that other step, you know, we got that. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit, or suggest we talk a little bit about a common problem we have, which is failure. We got a room full of failures here. We all hit the wall somewhere, and we failed. I don't know. We've talked a little bit today about how you find God and what's it like when you find God. I told you last night that I'm a pretty good observer. I critically watch the activities around me. That's not that that's an asset, but that's just what I do. And I noticed that people were getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw something happening here. People were changing. And I couldn't ascribe that to anything except what was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I thought about this, as I searched for my idea of what God is, I began to think about things that produced results that I couldn't see, like gravity. You can't see gravity, but it works all the time, thank God, or we'd float off this damn planet. And it's measurable. You can step off the roof here and it'll bust your ass every time, the same amount of time as you go down. It's just as constant as it can be. There's a power that works the same way in this universe. I had a professor in law school, and he talked about direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. Direct evidence, he said, was like if you had a dairyman who was charged with watering his milk before he sold it to the public. If you saw somebody that watched him and saw him pour water in the bottles and in milk, you'd have direct evidence of his violation of the health code. But he said there's an equally dynamic and powerful proof that's circumstantial. If you took a bottle of his milk in the courtroom and poured it out in a bowl, with a glass bowl, and you saw a minnow swimming around in it, that would be circumstantial evidence of what. And what we have to do, we're not ever going to see the power, per se. I don't think we are. Maybe we will. But we see evidence of it. And the evidence is all around us if we are attuned and looking for it. And so our job, if we're trying to find the power, is to look for evidence of the power. Now, we've all experienced failure. And I believe that we live in a self-correcting universe. I think when you mess up, this power has a way of showing you. It'd be a terrible place to live if you never knew you made a mistake. If you were trying to get to Detroit, and you went and turned right, and when you wound up in Miami and didn't know why you got there, you know, you need to know when you're making a mistake. And failure is our way of doing that. We have to know when we make a mistake. Now, with the alcoholic mind, this is difficult. The alcoholic mind doesn't work quite like everybody else's does. I had a guy tell me one day that his alcoholic mind would have killed his body, except he needed it for transportation. And this alcoholic mind of mine, when I reacted to failure by denying it, it didn't happen. Explaining it, rationalizing, justification, suppression, blaming somebody else, whatever, you know. I smoked for a long time. My wife didn't like me to smoke. She didn't like me to drink. She didn't like a hell of a lot of things I did, but she she stuck around, and I had a habit. She'd put me to bed a lot of times without taking me to the bathroom, which was a real bad mistake. And it's kind of embarrassing to tell you this, but it's a fact. So I would get up, and I was an automatic smoker. When I swung around, my feet hit the floor, my left hand went out to the end table, and there was my cigarettes and lighter. Didn't matter how drunk I was, there they were. And I'd light up and use that light to get around the house to find the bathroom. You got to be careful. You know, closets look a lot like bathrooms. Once in a while, you make a mistake. And it causes a conflict in the family every time you do that. Then I would come back, And I would sit on the edge of the bed. And you sit on the edge of the bed and you need to finish the cigarette. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but drinking made me tired. I'd smoke about half that cigarette and then I'd need to lie down. And I'd lay back down. And there was a time or two when I burned little holes in the tiny little holes. Just barely could see the damn things. You know. It was no big deal. I'm telling you, it was no big deal. And then one night I woke up and there was a pretty good sized fire going on my side of the bed. And we got up and we put the fire out. And I had to either sleep on a wet bed or go somewhere else and find. I don't remember what I did, but I didn't enjoy it much the rest of the evening. And then you have the question of, how did that happen? And you have to come up with an answer to that question. My answer was, I think it was on fire when I got in there. It doesn't work very well, but you might as well try it. What the hell? But that's the way I worked. That's the way I saw things. And you can defer facing reality for a while. You can keep pushing it off. We all did with our drinking. We didn't just get drunk and make an ass of ourselves and have a terrible hangover and crave alcohol one time and get up. We went through a long process of explaining why it happened, and it was some pills that I took, or I hadn't eaten that day, or there are thousands of rationalizations and justifications for the failures that we experience day after day after day as alcoholics. And we never learn anything from that. We don't learn very much as alcoholics from success. When we have success, the ego raises up and we just, you know, it's our brilliance. I'm a smooth-talking son of a bitch. That's how I won that lawsuit, you know. And the fact is, we don't learn a lot of that, but we learn a lot. I learn a lot more from my failures. I told you about, as a trial lawyer, I learned from my failures. I studied them. I understood, tried to understand what happened so that I would not repeat that mistake. But I didn't apply that in this major area of my life, and most of my life. I just did it in my profession. I learned a long time back that you have an opportunity in failure. There is a solution. In every failure, there's a seed of success. When I was a little kid, I wanted a bicycle. I lived out in the country, nobody else around me for half a mile, and they didn't have a bicycle, but I wanted a bicycle. Town kids had bicycles. I wanted a bicycle. So Dad ordered one out of the Sears and Roebuck catalog and put it together and set it up in the driveway and said, there it is. And I'd never thought about it, whether there was any problem riding a bicycle or not. There is. You don't just get on and ride a bicycle. I fell all over the damn ground out there and skinned myself up, and Mother run along beside me and hold me up and push me a little bit, and I'd fall over. And by the end of the day, I'd come to a great truth. I had a defective bicycle. No, I told my folks at dinner that night, ain't nobody can ride that damn bicycle. There's something wrong with that bicycle. And my mother was this little Irishman, and she said, I can ride that bicycle. I haven't ridden a bicycle since I was a little girl, but I can ride that bicycle. I said, you cannot. And she said, I'll show you. The next morning, she got up, and we went out, and she got on the damn bicycle, and she kind of stumbled around a little bit, and I didn't feel particularly sorry for her because I told her what that bicycle was like. Finally, she got the thing up, and she was wobbling along the driveway there riding the damn thing. And she laid it down on the ground, and she said, okay, that's all I'm going to do. That's all I'm doing about this bicycle. And she went in the house. An hour later, I was riding the bicycle. What man has done, man can do. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have bicycle riders in here that show people how to do it, that come out of failure to show how success is possible, that there's a way out for us. As a matter of fact, you can't find a greater failure story than Alcoholics Anonymous. If you just begin to think about how this thing got put together, you can't get to the post office from here. You just can't do it. Mr. Carl Jung over there thought he had a solution for alcoholism. And he started out with a guy named Roland Hazard and tried to tell him about how he could stay. Roland stayed with him a year and then got drunk before he got on the boat to go home. Came back and said, "Is there no hope for me?" Abject failure. But he was teachable at that point. And Carl Jung said, "Yes, there is hope for you, and that hope is that you find a spiritual movement somewhere. Because I see once in a while people of your type of alcoholism who find sobriety through a revolutionary change in their values and their ideas, and that's stories in your book." Roland went off and found the Oxford movement and got sober. And he took the message to Ebby, who was at the bottom of his barrel. He was where he was teachable for just a little while. And Ebby, of course, took it to Bill. Bill took it to Bob. And Alcoholics Anonymous grew out of those men's failure and the ability to communicate with one another toward a solution, toward a spiritual solution. Success arising out of failure. Bill started off with his early 12-step work for 12 months. Somebody read about this last night or talked about this last night. For the first 6 or 8 months, he preached to people. He went to the hospital and told them about his spiritual experience, and by God, he wanted them to have one. And finally, Dr. Silkworth told him, "You know, Bill, maybe if you quit preaching and just told them what happened to you, it might work." And that's what he tried in Akron when he met Bob Smith. And then, of course, we had a period of just blazing success when they started trying to write a book. Damn near tore up AA because they couldn't get along with each other. And the Rockefeller dinner, that was going to be a big success. I met Clarence S., Clarence Snyder. Some of y'all, I'm sure, knew him. Clarence was at that dinner. He said the drunks were there. They were planning things big. Some of them were going to be missionaries. Some of them were going to run treatment centers. Some of them, just as soon as they got this big ball of money from Mr. Rockefeller. Well, Mr. Rockefeller stood up and told all his rich friends who were there, "Don't give these drunks any money. You'll spoil the deal." Well, they failed in that effort to raise money. They failed in every effort they could think of to raise money. They tried publicity. They had notable people who showed up as members of Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to excite people into helping them out, and they all failed. The examples got drunk, or it just didn't work. They tried book sales. They're going to make a lot of money on books. Just as soon as they could publicize that book, they got on radio on the Gabriel Heater show, got one of their drunks, they watched him carefully all night long so he wouldn't get drunk. And he had some experience on radio, and they put him on there so he could help sell that book. And the next day or two, next week, they went to the post office carrying suitcases because there were going to be a lot of orders for books. They got 5 orders for books on that occasion. Now, you got to be you've got to be a little discouraged about this point in time, I would think. But they kept going, and they kept looking at their failures. And all the normal efforts that a promoter would make were tried by those early AAs, and none of them worked. The only thing that ever worked for them was the success they had in working with one another and the fact that somebody from outside, called a guy named Jack Alexander, wrote an article in the Saturday Evening Post describing this fellowship and authenticating it, and the result was astounding. There was all kinds of success that came from all those early failures. And the early failures produced an organization which we live in that you'd never think about putting together at all. You know, we have group conscience. Who ever heard of a group conscience run an organization. We have membership, if you choose to belong. Nobody's, no limitations on members at all. That grew out of that, those failures to try to screen who came to Alcoholics Anonymous. As Paul Keebler, I was telling you about one time, I asked him, I said, Paul, what do you think about this business of alcoholics? Alcoholics and drugs. And I said, what do you think about that? He said, well, he said, I'll tell you, Jerry, he said, we've always been, some people in AA have always been looking for ways to exclude members, but Bill wrote in those traditions that just a desire to stop drinking was enough. See, when I came, it was whether you were a functional or a non-functional alcoholic. If you had a wristwatch or could drive a car, you were a functional alcoholic and you really weren't welcome. They wanted non-functional alcoholics. He said, I was very fortunate. He said, I was shaking so bad I couldn't dial a telephone when we had so they let me stay in without any argument. But he said, we've always been looking for that. We've always been looking for ways to exclude, and what the traditions and the failures we had with that effort produced was a membership that says you're in if you say you're in. Nobody can exclude you if you say you're in. Singleness of purpose. People wanted to do a lot of different things there, and we have singleness of purpose. Anonymity. That grew directly out of all those people trying to publicize this thing. Hemsley, who was a catcher for Bob Feller and a lot of movie stars. The failure rate was high, but we put together an organization that you try to set down to a businessman and explain to him how Alcoholics Anonymous works, and he looked, his eyes kind of glass over because this thing won't work. Can't work. But I believe those failures that we have, those failures are ways that we're led to the solution that we need to have. No group ever flourished with the kind of things that we got going on for us, and no one ever tried it. And we're not, they don't follow us much. We're trying to, I don't see many corporations formed with group conscience, or they are without money, or self-supporting. Who ever thought about that? And the reason we're self-supporting is because nobody would give drunks money. They found out a long time ago, giving drunks money is a bad mistake. Just don't do that. It'll never get anywhere but in a bottle of barrel. The failures and their lessons really helped us a lot. They worked a lot in my life. Somebody mentioned children earlier. I was trying to run my son's life for sure. He was doing pretty damn good. He was a good athlete. He was a student body president in his high school. My life was not going worth a damn, and his was going pretty good, so I hung around him a lot and tried to help him. I helped him I talked to his coaches a lot, gave them suggestions for how they could improve their teams. I talked to officials, umpires, and I was the guy hanging on the chicken wire in the back of the catcher's neck, talking to the umpire about his mother, and while my son was trying to get that same man to call balls and strikes, and it wasn't working very good. And I went to a meeting one night, and somebody said, we're talking about how you couldn't control your kids. You had to let your kids go. You had to let them be free. And I thought she was talking to me. So I went home and told Mike I wasn't going to go talk to any more officials. I wasn't going to go suggest any more plays to his coaches. I was going to go to his ball games. And he said he felt like he was rejected, but then he kind of liked the freedom that came from me getting out of the way, and my son and I are close today. Today he comes to me and asks me what I think he would like for me to do. And it's nice to be able to be confident to him. My daughter, I ignored her. I didn't have time. I was taking care of my son. And she was running around with a bunch of little girls. And all they did was tell secrets and giggle, and they wouldn't tell me what they were laughing about, and they wouldn't tell me what the hell the secrets were. So I didn't have anything to do with them. But after I got in the program, I got to thinking, well, I'm failing with this relationship with my daughter here. And I started trying to get close to her, and I couldn't make it. She's used to getting along without me, and she just wasn't going to have much to do with me. And one night I did something I didn't very seldom do. I asked my wife for advice. I can't get close to Karen. What should I do? She said, why don't you take Karen to lunch? Why don't you take Karen to dinner? I said, would she go? She said, I don't know. Ask her. So I asked her. I said, would you go to dinner with me? Why? Well, because I'd like to spend a little time with you. Where would we go? Anywhere you want to go. When? Anytime you'll go. Well, okay. Real enthusiasm there. But we went. And out of that failure and my recognition of that failure, my acceptance of the failure that I was not doing what I was supposed to be doing with that daughter, and going and sit, all I did was sit and listen to her, ask her a few questions about her life and let her begin to talk about it, and she just flourished under that. She and I are extremely close today. And every time I get a chance, I take her to dinner. I quit when I was, after 2 or 3 weeks, I quit asking her because I didn't want to get into managing her like I was managing my son. And I just stopped and waited. And the first week she didn't say anything about it. And the next week she said, Daddy, aren't we going to go to dinner anymore? And I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to go to dinner some more. And that's been the story of my life. If I can address and accept my failures, look at them carefully and learn from them, they're a real blessing to me. They really help me a lot. We have a prayer. We just got through saying it earlier today, the Serenity Prayer. That prayer was extremely and has been today still extremely important to me. In the beginning, I didn't know there was but one line. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change. I want a drink and I can't change it. I'm an alcoholic and I can't change it. I'm never going to get over it and I can't change it. A little later on, I found out that there was another line to it. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and the courage to change the things I can. So I began to try to change the things I can. And then finally, after a longer period of time, I began to try to change things. Sometimes I was successful and sometimes I wasn't. But if you look at that last long, the wisdom to know the difference. I talked to you earlier today about resistance. I don't care how long you've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or what spiritual belief you have or wherever you are, you're going to encounter resistance in your life. Resistance is a way that you are allowed to mature and grow spiritually and to mature as a human being. And as you pray for that wisdom there, you begin to recognize over time, this didn't work last time. It probably won't work this time. This worked last time. I can probably change it this time. And you begin to develop some wisdom, something you can't transfer to anybody else. It's homegrown. And each generation and each person has to develop his own wise ways. Wisdom grows up out of failures. Wisdom comes out also out of successes, but only when we recognize that we're not responsible for the success. The way you process failures is through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best way I know anyway. And I've been offended a lot from failure. It's been a real blessing to me to be able to fail and know that I'm going the wrong way and to stop, look, and begin to go another way. And if y'all want to talk about that a little, or just stand, there's a microphone there. We can talk about it, or we can turn this over to a recess, and we'll hear some real good conversation from some group discussions we're going to have later on. Yes, sir.
Jerry, you mentioned singleness of purpose and that there were failures that brought us to that. Would you do a little history and talk about singleness of purpose just a little bit?
Well, in the beginning there was a, and there still is. Anyone who ever got sober and got the program of Alcoholics Anonymous working in their life, begins to think, you know, this damn thing would be good for anybody. This would be great. We had a very large Baptist church in Dallas, Texas, and there was a Reverend Criswell who was largely a founder of that church, and he came to an AA meeting one time with one of his parishioners, and the next week he brought his board with him. Because he said, if I could get this thing going in my church, like you got it going here, it would be gangbusters. But we haven't got any business trying to run a church. That's not our deal. The more we have scattered out, the more we get scattered out and try to solve other things. We got a lot of 12-step programs. We're really glad, happy, that a lot of people have adopted this process to their specific problem. But we got to focus on what we have, what our problem is. And it's confusing sometimes today. It's very confusing for me. A lot of the young people that I see, and we got a bunch of people here from Discovery, I don't know about a lot of them, but I'll just bet you there's some drugs involved with almost every one of them. And if I had been partying and playing in that period of time, there'd been some drugs involved in my recovery. And a lot of them come to us, they don't have a damned idea what they're addicted to. They may be addicted to everything. But the fact is, we're focused on one thing, and that's alcoholism. We ask you when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous to focus on that one drug, that one problem. Yeah, okay, so you had some drinks, but did you go back, you took some pills or smoked some high-octane cigarettes. Did you go back to alcohol? How much time did you spend on alcohol? And the singleness of purpose, Bill very wisely decided, and the early members of AA decided, we better stay with what we have. The Washingtonians were a group that was formed before Alcoholics Anonymous. They were just after the Civil War, I believe it was. And they had great success trying to get people to take the pledge of sobriety, not drink, that sort of thing. But the first thing you know, politics began to enter into. People were looking for endorsements of one type or another. One group wanted to go one way, one group wanted to go the other, and they forgot their primary purpose. And in a short period of time, they were just a fading memory. They just couldn't keep it together. And Bill drew a lot from the experience of the Washingtonians on the singleness of purpose idea. And he made a right decision, in my opinion. Is that it? Good show.